Yo, check this out. This is Fresh Get Out the China Man with the 2 Live Crew.
Yo, what's up, y'all? It's me, DMC.
What's up, y'all? This is the Boy Master P.
Yo, check us out. Chuck the Public Enemy.
Yo, what's up? This is DJ Yella from the world's most dangerous group.
What's up? This is DLC.
This is your boy, C Murder.
This is Jerry Heller, motherfucker.
This is your boy, DJ Paul KOL 365.
Young Busy Ball.
Vice One.
Yo, this is DJ Ready Red.
What up? This is the real Rick Ross. You listen to me on the Murder Master Music Show.
This is the show that shows no limits, broadcast nothing but the real. Interviews with legendary artists, still got love for the underground feel. Rappers with records, reveal the addition of rappers that are coming up, get them put on. We needed a platform to fight the mainstream. This is the show that you need to be on. Hit up UGS for life on screen and follow up with us.com. For all of your needs, production and mixing and mastering, grab it, just download the time. Check out the archives and touch with the shows, buddy, your content is muted.
We represent all them chillers on the mic, and we should love to all you fans. Motherfuckers wanna hate, do your thing, you keep the focus, bringing nothing but the reason. Come and tune into the dopest.
I'm a madman, going crazy, knocking all you rappers off. It's underground society, it's UGS yes, for life, dog. Hip hop ain't dead, represent for the legends. Rapping mumble rappers, so we ain't sitting on the hip. Tupac and P, dreaming, thank you for the bliss. It's a murder man.
What's up, everybody? It's your boy Prez. Welcome to the Murder Master Music Show. This is episode 648. We have a return guest to the show. He really needs no introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway. We're talking about the homie DJ Clientele. He's got a book, it's out right now today. I want everybody to get it. It's called The Autobiography, Essays and Writings of a Modern Day Renaissance Man by Mark Hawkins, a.k.a. DJ Clientele. That's just the tip of the iceberg, because we got to talk about some film, some music. I mean, this guy's doing it all, and he's been doing it all. Let's bring him on right now, Mr. Renaissance Man himself. How you doing, Clientele?
Hey, what's up, Prez? How you doing, man? I'm chilling. I'm doing good.
Well, man, it's a huge honor, to have you on at any time. But congratulations on this book, because I know it's something you've been working on, and it's something that's very vital to you, to document what you've done over the years. What made you want to write this book?
Well, it's been a long time coming, man, to be honest. And I wanted to do something really that sort of sets the historical record straight, straight from, L.A. and Compton and growing up there and being a part of that early West Coast hip hop scene and then subsequently the whole of entertainment. I just wanted to do something that filled in some gaps, sort of dispelled, some of the mythical, stories that were out there and kind of just really let people know a little bit more about, my experiences and how I grew up and my influences, but also to just make sure that the historical record was accurate and for things not to sort of get pushed to the margins because, so often, people's memories fade or people have their own sort of perspective on things, which causes for certain items to be neglected. But I think it's important for, the culture, the hip-hop culture and the fans of hip-hop and people who love it to really get a full sort of understanding, a 360 understanding of hip-hop. And that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to, to put this work together and give people that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always important that we are able to tell our own stories, too, because so many people out there, they'll want to tell it for you. Was that part of your motivation too, like you said, to get it right, to make sure that nobody else screwed things up?
Absolutely, man. And it's nothing, out of, narcissism or arrogance. It's more about, because I'm a historian too. So I always try to make sure that, the research is accurate as possible, that the narrative is accurate as possible. Because I think, man, it's important that people sort of understand for other generations and just people in general who are coming into the culture or trying to understand the culture, that how it happened, how it evolved, what were the motivations, you know, who were the major, you know, players, and who did what to really make it, you know, what it is. And it's important for those who are coming after us, but also those who have gone on and maybe, you know, some of who have passed away, they don't get a chance to really tell their stories. So, yeah, you're right, man. It was just something that I felt was necessary so that the story would just get told right and, you know, correctly. Like, you know, I'll give you an example of something that's in the book. A lot of people don't know that even after, you know, Dre and Cube, you know, went on from and left to do their own thing from Ruthless Records, I started working with Eazy-E. In fact, I was in the studio and I did a drop for the Ruthless Radio Show. And Eazy turned to me and said, "Hey, man, you want to do something? You know, can you do something on this drop?" So I did the drop, me and Yella, just like old times. And then after that, Eazy and I started talking about working on a studio album together, you know. So that's something that's not in the Straight Outta Compton movie, you know. So there are connecting dots, you know, that needed to be put into this whole narrative so that people could get, again, a 360-degree understanding of what the historical record is.
Now, Eazy, as you know, Eazy-E, you know, rest in peace. He's a huge part of our show. We just recently interviewed Cemetery Tim, who did the new tombstone for him, and as well as his daughter, Erica Wright. She was on the show to speak about that tombstone unveiling. Now, what was your relationship like with Eazy-E? I know you said you were talking about working with him and stuff towards the end of his life. Mm-hmm. What about like the early days of NWA? Were you ever, you know, considered to be part of that group?
You know, they had asked me to join, and I wasn't in a frame of mind to do that because, one, a lot of the stuff that they were doing or some of the, you know, stuff that they were rapping about, that just wasn't me. And I was in college, so I had to sort of represent a certain different kind of agenda, you know. And, you know, back then, you know, what people – should understand is that, you know, when you're in college and at a university and you're in a particular program or department, a lot of that, you know, who you are and your character is a part of that responsibility. So I knew that the professors and the folks in that particular department wouldn't, you know, appreciate if I was, you know, out there, you know, talking one thing, you know, on the records, but trying to live another way and trying to promote something completely different, you know, at school and represent something different, you know, at school. It may be a little different now, but still, again, you know, I was in the African ethnic studies, you know, department. And a lot of those professors were very, very big on, you know, Afrocentricity and uplifting the community and building on, you know, the legacy of, you know, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Marcus Garvey and W.E.B. Du Bois and, you know, Frederick Douglass and people like that. So what would I look like, you know, rapping about, you know, robbing, killing, stealing while, you know, I'm in this program to try and uplift the community and build a better sort of, you know, America. Also, I had a deal with Sutra Records, you know, at the time, and as a solo artist. So, you know, I was in that contract, sort of in that vein as well. So there were a lot of factors involved with me not, you know, getting involved or joining up with NWA. Although I love their music, man, don't get me wrong. Those are my brothers, you know, for life, and I was so proud of their journey and their success. But I was just tied to sort of a different agenda, a different track that I was on at that time.
Rendezvous kind of said something similar too. It just stuff they were rapping about just wasn't him. And I appreciate you guys
right.
being real and authentic, because so many people fake the funk, so to speak, including most NWA, excluding Eazy. He seemed to be like the only dude that, or Ren too, from what I hear, the only two guys that were really in the streets, so to speak. But later on, you know, after NWA had their run and everything, Eazy-E was doing the radio show. You and him were talking about doing some stuff. Were there any talks about you possibly signing the Ruthless? Because I know you dropped the G-Funk album year after Eazy died in 96. Was that something that maybe you wanted to put on Ruthless?
You know, it would have been something that helped inspire that. Because Eazy, in fact, some of those tracks that came off of the, you know, Shining on the Funk album would have probably been in that direction, you know, with what Eazy was doing and the Ruthless family. Yeah, but that was definitely something I would have been looking forward to, you know, working with, you know, with him on. And, you know, my perspective was more about how do we display lyricism with context of, you know, our West Coast vibe that was happening at that time, but also still give the people those, you know, those catchy dance tunes and just sort of, you know, be a well-rounded artist. Because again, you know, my musical roots were actually in music. You know, my grandfather, Curtis Knight, also known as Curtis McNear, was best friends with Jimi Hendrix, and they were in a band together. They played together. They wrote, you know, songs together. And you know, he wrote two books about Jimmy and those experiences, even after Jimmy came back from the experience. They did, you know, music together. And my father was a horn player. You know, my grandmother was in a gospel singing group. I'm related to the, you know, the Hawkins family who, you know, wrote the song Oh Happy Day. So my familial musical roots were solid, you know, in that, and my DNA is from that. So I always wanted to do, you know, things in music, but just be a well-rounded artist. I never wanted to just limit myself to sort of one vein or one genre. And so that's, you know, that's kind of like what I had talked with Eazy about. And he understood that. He respected that, you know, and that's the direction I wanted to go in.
Yeah, it's almost like you have the similar visionary you know, to Eazy, you know what I'm saying? Like, you have your hand and your mind set in a lot of different things, you know what I'm saying, whether it be the, you know, the book or film or music. You know, did you and Eazy have that type of connection? Like, were you guys able to throw ideas back and forth off each other?
Yeah, I think so. And that's what I admired about him, because he wasn't a person of a lot of words. He was a man of few words, but he had vision. You could tell he was always thinking. You know, he's always thinking, you know, nine steps ahead, and he wouldn't necessarily come right out and tell you, you know, let's do A, B, C, or D. He would kind of suggest certain things or ask the question and sort of give you the option, you know, of, you know, doing it or not. Oh, yeah, man, that's a good idea, you know, that kind of thing. So he was a smart dude. You know, he wasn't, by any measure, he was I guess, the kind of person that wanted everybody to sort of see the bigger picture.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at this point in time, you know, when he passed, you know, what were your initial thoughts, you know what I'm saying, about how he passed? And do you believe the theory that he just simply died of AIDS?
You know, my reaction was very sad by that, you know, because it was somebody I knew. And at that time, you know, the whole, you know, HIV AIDS epidemic was still, it spooked a lot of people, because, you know, folks didn't know, they had some knowledge, but it was still like, well, you know, how do you get it? Do you get it from eating something, or do you get it from touching something, or do you get it from, you know, what? And people were still sort of afraid of that. And at that time, there were no treatments, you know, really. There was absolutely no cure. So when he contracted, you know, it, I mean, you couldn't tell, you know, you didn't know until towards the end of his life that he was really sick. So, you know, my reaction was really, I was, you know, heartbroken, saddened by that, because I know he was a good dude. And, you know, as far as the theories go, about if he contracted or how he contracted it, I mean, I don't know. I have no knowledge whatsoever, you know, of that. And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, it will come to light one day. I know that his family was working on a documentary on that and trying to get to the bottom of that. So I hope that one day that, you know, it does come to light, you know, however it happened.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. Because there's so many questions about it, you know, especially the fact that nobody else got it, none of the kids, none of the women, and with from 30 days, you know, he didn't even have HIV to having full-blown AIDS and dying. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Now, you know, rest in peace to Easy, of course, true pioneer on all levels. Yourself, you know what I'm saying, your music career goes back, you know, long before the NWA days, you know, like you said, it was in your family. When did you first get involved, you know, with Lonzo and everybody in the World Class Wrecking Crew?
Well, you know, I was in a rap group and a DJ crew called The Invasion Force, sort of patterned after Soul Sonic Force, you know, because those are our references back then. That's what we had to go with, you know. And that was with me, Joe Cooley, Carlos, Nick. Crazy Tunes came along eventually a little later on to be a part of that. DJ Aladdin also was a part of that. And DJ Speed, you know, was a part of that as well. So that crew that we had was just a group of guys who wanted to be DJs. We would go up to the Uncle Jam's Army parties. We were still in high school. And we said, man, let's just put our own little crew together. So we, you know, got our chips together. Start buying some equipment and borrowing equipment and doing little gigs here and there, little backyard birthday parties. Eventually, we graduated to doing house parties, you know, on the weekends. Some house parties we would do, man, eventually when we started to grow our business, was so packed that by the end of the party, when everybody left, you know, there were blue jean stains all along the walls. Then we started doing, like, school dances. And then graduated up to just doing our own sort of, you know, promotional stuff. And then eventually, one day, we would go to the club, Eve After Dark, where Lonzo and the Wrecking Crew would be. And at that time, they were called Disco Construction Productions, and they had their crew there, but they were just DJs at the club, and then they would rent out equipment as a mobile DJ company. And Lonzo would throw these contests every now and then, and I was the rapper in our crew. I was the MC. Joe Cooley and the other guys, they were more or less on the turntables. And Joe and I would do these routines back and forth, you know, at our little, you know, our parties and the school dances. And so we had another friend of mine, his name was McKinley. And we would go to these, you know, Eve After Dark, you know, sort of dances, and not really to even dance. We'd go there to check out the DJs. You know, we'd go to Uncle Jam's Army parties to check out the DJs, you know. And DJ Yella at that time was like, he was like the top DJ in the neighborhood. You know, everybody knew him. You know, he had his mixing going and all that kind of stuff because he had learned from Davey DMX. So we went there one night, and Lonzo was like, yo, we're going to have this contest. It's a rap contest next week. Come on back. You know, bring your best rhymes, whatever. You win $100. So me and my buddy McKinley, we looked at each other, oh, man, we're going to win this. So we went, worked all week, man, on this dope routine, like Double Trouble and, you know, like Treacherous 3. We, you know, we had it going back and forth. We did the harmony raps and all that kind of stuff. And we had it down tight. So that day of the contest, we were supposed to go to the club. He called me up saying he couldn't make it. So I'm like, man, we done worked on this thing all week, and, you know, we got it down tight. What am I supposed to do now? And he's like, well, just go do one of those routines you do with Joe Cooley, man. You know, you'll be all right. You'll be fine. So, all right, man, whatever. So I went up there, and the thing that I noticed was that none of the rappers, none of the MCs were engaging the crowd. They were all just talking about themselves. Yeah, baby, I got cars, I got clothes, I got this, I got that, I got the Gucci, I got the, you know, Fila watch, all that kind of stuff. And I said, you know what, it's about the people. You know, hip-hop is about the culture, it's about the people, it's about getting the crowd involved. So I got up and just, bam, start, you know, hitting it with the call and response and then doing my little routines and doing all that. And the crowd went crazy, man, and they loved it. And so Lonzo, I won the contest. Lonzo pulled me to the side. He said, hey, man, you know, I'm working on this thing. Got some ideas. How about you come back, you know, this week on Wednesday, and I'll talk to you about it some more. So I'm sitting there like, oh, yeah, that's all cool. But this dude ain't paid me my money yet. So where's my $100 at? So I said, well, I guess I'm going to come back Wednesday to make sure I get my money. So I went that Wednesday, and I noticed that it was a skinny dude on the turntables that I knew from junior high school. And I said, oh, that's Dre. I said, he must be a part of this. So I said, well, if he a part of this, this might be cool. So I'm going to hear out, you know, what dude's got to say, and then I'll see what's up from there. So, yeah, Alonzo, we talked about it. He said, yeah, man, I'm going to be making some records. I'm making some moves. I've been looking for, you know, an MC and a rapper, you know, like you. So I'm thinking, like, well, man, I'm already a crew. What am I supposed to do? So he gave me my money. He paid me my $100. And I said, what's up to Dre? And I went back and talked to my boys. I said, hey, man, look, you know, this might be something cool for everybody. Let me go and check it out. You know, I'm going to keep one foot here and one foot there. And when I get a chance, I'm going to pull y'all into some stuff. And I did. You know, I like Joe Cooley would come up there, and I'd sneak him into my sets on the turntables, because little did Lonzo know that I was also a DJ too. But when he found that out, he's like, oh, man, it's icing on the cake. So I would take like that first hour for the Wrecking Crew, and then, you know, I think Dre would come after me, then Yella would do the prime spot, and maybe Lonzo or DJ Unknown would fill out that, that, you know, that last half. So I did that for a while, and then we finally got into the studio, and Lonzo was like, well, you know, you ready? It was my first time ever being in the studio. He booked some studio time. I think he might have booked like 4 hours studio time. But what he also didn't know was I had a photogenic memory at the time. Like, I could look at something once or twice, and I had it down. You know, Rapper's Delight, when I first heard the song, went, bought it from the store, listened to it like once, and had the whole record, you know, down. I could read something and get it down right. So went to the studio, man. I did the song in one take, and they were looking at me like, well, damn, what are we going to do now, you know? So Yella was like, hold on, let me program another beat. So we had borrowed the drum machine. It was a Linn drum, and it was really like a little rinky-dink studio we were in. So Yella flipped the beat real quick, recorded something, and I already had rhymes in my head. So I went in there into the booth, bam, knocked out another, you know, another song in like, you know, 4 or 5 minutes. And, you know, Yella mixed some stuff down, and we were out of there in like 45 minutes, man, tops, I think. You know, with 4 hours of studio time booked. So we bailed out of there. We put the song together. We pressed it up. And this was our first song ever called Slice. We knew nothing about the music industry. We knew nothing about how to, you know, sell a record, how to put it in the stores, how to get it distributed. But from that experience, we just learned how to do it, you know, from just going into the mom and pop stores. Hey, can you take, you know, 5 or 10 of these, and we come back next week and see how they sold, and, you know, going to different distributors and going, hey, can you take a few of these? Can you make, you know, order some of these? And so out of that whole process, I was learning, you know, not only just the music side of it, but I was also learning the business side of it. And I think that's why I sort of, you know, became both just a musician and also a businessman. But to answer your question, that's kind of like how I got started in the music industry.
And that's history right there, folks. You know what I'm saying? Most definitely. Clientele, I want to hold the line for a minute. I want to go to a song, and I want to come back and chop it up more about your incredible history in the game, as well as, you know, what else you got coming out in addition to this book. Now, this song here, off the Fuck the Lamestream project, it's with you and my brother Emo, produced by D-Tag, called Let's Ride. Man, I want to thank you first and foremost, because when I was putting this project together, I reached out to a lot of cats, you know what I'm saying, and I didn't hear back from them. You, not only did I hear back from you, but I had a song in my inbox very quick, and this is it. I really appreciate it, man. Let's ride. We'll be right back.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. UGS for life, baby. Yogi shit. Pull up on a wannabe MC, I
do is just kill niggas. Shouts out to my real niggas. Out here on the west, we seeing death like it's a common thing. So I'ma go into the hook and let the homies sing.
Come
take a ride with me.
Right there, man. That's some G-funk, real hip-hop. You know what I'm saying? Good blend of some Southern and Northern California G-funk. Man, that
man.
Right there. I love that track, man. You guys killed it.
Hey, man. Man, shout out to Emo and D-Tag, man. Yeah, I mean, it was fun working with those brothers, those cats, man. It was good stuff, man. Yeah, that's one of my favorites, too. Love it.
What's it like for you, you know, being a West Coast artist, one of the pioneers, in fact, one of the earlier rappers from the West Coast, hearing a guy from the Netherlands produce a funky West Coast track like that? How does that make you feel knowing that your stuff stretched all the way around the globe?
I know, man. I mean, it's crazy, right? Because, you know, a lot of times us as artists, you know, we're working in a studio, in a confined space, or we might be in, you know, our own little, you know, offices or rooms or whatever, you know, working on our stuff. And then, you know, you put something together and you put it out there, you know, in your mind, you're thinking, well, maybe a few people might hear it there, you know, maybe this person might like it or these people might like it. But then to have your music influence generations and geographic, you know, locations that are all over the world, it is a humbling thing, man. It's surreal. And yeah, to have a cat like D-Tag, who you think, you know, the way he produces sounds like he grew up, you know, right in the heart of, you know, Southern California, is like, wow. You know, it's an amazing thing to experience that. But yeah, shout out, man, to him. He did a hell of a job on that track, man. And, you know, it just, everything just flowed, you know, on that. And, you know, Emo with his, you know, his sort of his, that, you know, up north, you know, kind of flow that he put on it. I think it was a really good combination there.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, and last year we both put out dope compilations for the art form of hip hop, you know, with Fuck the Lame Stream. And of course,
yeah,
you put out 16 bars for hip hop.
Yeah.
And, it sucks that the projects didn't get revered as they should, because they were all about hip hop. You know,
yeah.
Why do you think that hip hop media kind of slacks on the art form and it's more about like the trends and the gimmicks?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I do a lot of lectures at, you know, colleges and universities and you know, different places, and I sit on panels. And one of the things that I tell people is that it's important for us in the culture to distinguish between, you know, the rap industry and hip hop culture, because the rap industry is about business and profit and the profit motive and selling and making money and sort of doing the thing that they think is going to be the trend or the next trend, or the thing that is going to, you know, touch or sell to the masses of people, even people who are not about the culture, but just to sell to the masses. So that part of the business is sort of like what picks up on, you know, the popularity of things, or, you know, the thing that is going to be the, you know, the hot, shiny object for right now. Hip-hop culture, on the other hand, is what sustains us and has lasted for 40 plus years as a lifestyle, as a belief system, you know, as an effort to sort of continue and pass on from one generation to the next, the core principles, you know, the five elements, so to speak, you know. And I think the most important element, though, even though we talk about, you know, the DJing and, you know, the MCing and the B-boy, B-girlism and the graffiti art. But the most important element is the one that doesn't get talked about enough, is the knowledge. And it's really become incumbent upon us to bestow that knowledge from one generation to the next. And I think that's what we're about. And as long as we do that, I think we'll continue to thrive as a culture. But the business is going to do what it's going to do. But the culture is our responsibility. It's bestowed upon us to make that a sustainable item, you know, for generations to come.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, the educational aspect of it, it's just non-existent. And we have to teach the youth, you know what I'm saying, the history. And just like when you came up, you know, those before you, like you were mentioning, you know, you knew about them and you had respect for them. That's what's missing today, too. These guys don't have the respect, you know, that ones before them
you know,
had.
One time back in the day, we had released Wrecking Crew. We had just done our first studio album called World Class. And we were at a place called Skateland USA. Skateland was a place, it was a skating ring that was built right in the neighborhood by Craig Schwarzinger. And we would have remotes there with K-Day and Greg Mack and those guys. And one of the highlights of something that happened to me was Curtis Blow walked up to me and said, "Hey, man, you guys did this song I really love. I want to buy it." And I, you know, first of all, to me, Curtis was an icon in hip hop, you know, and not only, you know, an East Coast icon, but just an icon in hip hop, period. I knew who he was. And for him to come up to me and say, "Hey, man, the song you wrote, I want to buy it." I thought to myself, like, wow, that, you know, that's amazing. You know, that an artist of his caliber, a person of his caliber is coming to me, you know, and wanting to buy a song that I had written. So that kind of, you know, homage a lot of times is lacking or missing from the generation sort of that didn't get that knowledge or didn't get an understanding of who paved the way and how difficult it was, you know. And I've now, you know, since, you know, heard the stories that Curtis has told and you know, 30 years later, we're friends. And I've, you know, he tells the stories of what he had to go through and what he had to experience just to get his music heard, just to get it played, just to get people to accept him as an artist, you know, and how he paved the way as a pioneer for us to come, that next generation, and be able to put it down. And, you know, a lot of what we went through, it's important, you know, for these generations to understand. And again, I'm not, you know, one of those crotchety old dudes going, you know, F all these, you know, younger artists, they don't know anything they're talking about. No, it's my job to educate them, and it's my job to help them to understand what it is that they're really involving themselves in, what they've really gotten themselves into. Because the last thing I want to happen to them is to go through some of those pitfalls and experiences of getting, you know, beat on their money, ripped off by record labels, you know, their entire identity, you know, being, you know, dictated to them, and they have no say in their own, you know, program. The last thing I want is to happen to them. So if I can do anything to help, you know, them to survive that and not have to go through those same, you know, circumstances, then, you know, that's what I'm here for. You know, that's what I'm all about, that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I salute you for that, man, because not enough people are doing that. If we could have more cats doing that, I think the foundation will be secure forever.
People will get a, you know, a better understanding of what this culture truly means, because it was born out of the oppressive conditions of Black, Latino, and white youth. You know, we created something out of nothing, because we had nothing and we needed something, and, you know, the government and society wasn't giving it to us. So we had to do something, you know, out of that. I mean, you know, hip hop in New York was created out of, you know, what the slumlords were doing, you know, in the Bronx and in Harlem and in Brooklyn and places like that, where the kids, you know, needed an outlet. And if they didn't have an outlet, they were going to continue, you know, being in gangs and killing each other. And then on the West Coast, You know, it was born out of a need to express ourselves in that way, you know, and we just took it and ran with it because, like I said again, we made something out of completely nothing, literally nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I'm sorry, but what were you going to say? I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I was just going to say, you got to have more people involved in order to keep the preservation going. You know, you've done a lot of work with the Universal Hip Hop Museum.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying, on the West Coast side. Do you have any developments on the whole situation with the Universal Hip Hop Museum?
Oh, yeah. Lots of developments as of late. In fact, I think the first time we may have talked about it, we were just still in the planning stages, trying to get things together, getting the architectural plans together. We've now gotten, a group of architects that have donated their time and their expertise to designing it. Mike Ford, the hip hop architect, is spearheading that whole campaign. We've got the land now, going to be breaking ground real soon in the Bronx, right down the street from Yankee Stadium in a place called Bronx Point. And again, the reason why we do the Bronx is because, again, that's where we recognize the birth of hip hop, where all the five elements, intersected, where it all came together. Yeah, there were elements on the West Coast and elements in, down south and elements in other places. We get that. We understand that. We know that. But this is where we recognize where Kool Herc, did his thing and sort of married all of these elements together in one place. And that's where the birth of hip hop, is. But the program that we're putting together for hip hop, again, is about the music. It's about the educational experience, and it's about making sure that, and this is something, LL, we were on a conference call a couple of weeks ago, and this is something that LL Cool J said. He said that, look, man, it's more than just about what's here now or the people you already know. It's also about those cats who you don't know, the people who made a contribution to hip hop, who didn't get the recognition or who didn't get the big, label contracts or who didn't get to, spread their, music all over the world. So he said it's about that too. And that's what, the Universal Hip Hop Museum is about as well. And just educating, from that point. And we have some really deeply committed people involved, like 41 or so volunteers now. We have scholars from, the hip hop community and from academia. We have people from, the recording industry involved, the music industry involved, because people, have now seen all of the, hard work and the momentum is there now. And we've been able to raise upwards of about $30 million now, going towards our goal of 80 plus million that, we need to actually build it out. But the developer is already established. It's going to be in mixed use space. There's going to be a school, that's involved with that. And it's going to be a part of a cultural hub created, in this whole Bronx Point area. And not only that, our outreach is going to be just from, not just there, but also all over the world. We have our sister organization, Generation Hip Hop, which is in, 50 plus countries now. And we're going to be attached in a part of that, just making sure that hip hop culture is alive and well and thriving in many nations around the world. So that's what we're, that's what we're doing now.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. The book, I'm saying, drops on the 20th. Let everybody know the name of the book
today.
Again. Yeah,
so
actually, today, not right now. So if you're hearing this, you got to get this book.
So, it's DJ Clientele, The Autobiography, Essays, and Writings of a Modern-Day Renaissance Man. And I know it seems, to some people like a modern-day Renaissance man seems a bit of an oxymoron. But, in reality, in every Renaissance, there's always a change, right, a revolution, that takes place. And, I talk about it. My own renaissance, my own revolutionary change, my own evolution, as a person, but then also the need for a renaissance and an evolution in our culture, and in hip hop, and then just in the world in general, politically, socially, economically, because in the book, I do talk about my history, but there are also some essays that I've included and some writings that I've included that are from my perspective, you know, in terms of, you know, on a scholarly level, of some historical things, you know, like
oh,
I have essays in there about the evolution and the convergence of, you know, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. I talk about, you know, Black Los Angeles.
From your perspective,
the history of Black
though,
LA.
Right?
Yeah. From
oh,
my
wow.
perspective and yeah, the history of Black Los Angeles. I talk about there's some surprises, you know, there. It's not just a book about music. It's a book about, because again, man, you know, what people neglect to realize, and I encounter this, you know, on occasion or understand about me, is that not only am I a musician, but I'm also a scholar and a historian. And you know, I have a master's degree, you know, and you know, I went to college and, like I said, and graduated. And I think that as an example, I try to lead by example and show people that there's not necessarily just one way of doing things or one way of pursuing, you know, your passions and your dreams and all of that, that there are other alternatives and there are people who can relate to you and you can relate to from many different sides. And it's okay to be who you are. So what if, you know, if you didn't get a chance to go to college or graduate from college, so what? It's okay. And if you did, it's okay. You know, do you live your life and live it to the fullest and be the best that you can be at what you do. And so I try to just give a range of thoughts, you know, and ideas and perspectives that people can get into. Some of them are controversial, you know, and I will admit that. But again, you know, there are things that I say in there that need to be said. I feel that need to be said.
Yeah, and that's, you know, so many people solely focus on their history when they're writing books like that. You know, for you to give your perspective on different things and different people, you know what I'm saying, who had an impact on history. That's pretty pretty mm-hmm. dope idea right there in itself. So it kind of becomes, the book
yeah.
kind of becomes like a multifaceted book versus just
absolutely.
one story about one person. That's
right.
Great, man. So the book's out right now. Everybody needs to go get it. But also, you know, you're working on a lot of film, you know, Blaze and Amused. You got a documentary
yeah.
on Einstein in the works. Can you talk about that stuff?
Oh, it's a movie. Sure. So the movie is a 420 friendly comedy called Blaze and Amused. And we're making some really good, you know, headway with that. We're probably going to start casting it sooner than later. What people need to understand about movie making that's a little different than music making is that movie making is a larger sort of scope, and it requires groups of people, teams of people to be involved to do it right. Yeah, I can grab a camera right now. I have a cinema, you know, certified cinema standard, you know, cinematic standard camera right now that's approved by, you know, the Netflix and all these other cinematic movie houses. They put out a list of, you know, equipment that is acceptable and standard, industry standard. So I have that already. I own one. I can go out, grab a camera right now and go out and start, you know, shooting. But to do films right and to do it with quality, it requires a team. It requires, you know, working within the studio system. And so that's what we're doing with Blaze and Amused, and making sure that, again, it's standard, it's quality, you know, that we want to tell a good story, but at the same time, we want to make sure that the story gets told and out there the right way. Yeah, so we're working on that. And then we also have the Einstein movie. It's actually a feature film that we're doing on Albert Einstein. I co-wrote it with Walter Mee and Valerie Mee, who are – Walter Mee was actually friends of Einstein's grandson. And so Einstein's grandson lived at his house, would stay at his house, and those are personal stories that he would tell. So out of that, there's a personal familial connection with Albert Einstein. And then people go, well, how does a rapper, you know, slash, you know, producer of music and you know, producer of music videos and movies get involved with Albert Einstein? Well, what a lot of people don't know about me too is that I'm a strong, you know, advocate and a strong sort of an amateur astronomer, you know, and I'm into cosmology and astrology, you know, astronomy, and, you know, the study of, you know, astrophysics and you know, that kind of stuff. So I'm a real big fan of, you know, quantum mechanics, and I'm into that kind of stuff. So naturally, I gravitated towards that. I actually, when I first, my first year in college, I was an electrical engineering student before I switched my major to African studies. So I was always into, you know, the sciences and you know, the understanding of, you know, the unknown and the understanding of things that, you know, out there, the Big Bang Theory and you know, Einstein's theory of relativity. So that's how I got involved with, you know, the whole writing and creation of a movie, you know, about Einstein. So that's how people go, well, what the hell, how does he get involved in that? But that's how. And then, you know, with the whole Blaze of the Muse, we wanted to do a comedy that was in the same genre as, you know, the Friday movie, the Half-Baked, Pineapple Express, and those kinds of movies. Because, again, man, I don't limit myself to just one thing. Thus, that's why I called the book, you know, Modern Day Renaissance Man, because I don't feel like, you know, we should put ourselves in a box or only allow other people to define us as who we are, but we should always seek knowledge and always seek to be curious about, you know, a lot of things, you know, and I think that's how we grow as people. And I think that's how we live a full and fulfilled, you know, kind of life. Cause the last thing I want is, you know, when I take my last breath is to say, well, man, I wish I would have done that. I wish I could have learned that. I wish I could have, you know, known that. I'm going to try to live it to the fullest and try to understand, you know, and gain as much knowledge about a lot of things as I can, you know. And it's made me a lot more tolerant of people, more understanding of other, you know, cultures and, you know, other countries and the way that they, you know, are. And then being able to have that knowledge and then travel to those nations and travel to those countries and experience firsthand how people live, it's a big deal, you know. And you, and I think you get a better experience and a better perspective. And, you know, when I was in Africa, you know, Al-Kibwa land or the motherland, and, you know, going around there and going to different places like, you know, Togo and Ghana and eventually to Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, I learned a lot. You know, I learned perspective, and it helped me to understand better, you know, how people live. And, you know, Africa is not a place of shithole countries, you know, like, you know, yeah. this dude in the White House, you know, current dude in the White House is saying, you know, it's a place.
Terrible tangerine. You know,
Agent Orange 45. But I saw places that would rival like Beverly Hills or some of the, you know, Cape Cod, you know, and then I saw places that were, you know, living in abject poverty. So the world is what it is, you know, and the world is constantly evolving and changing, and people are people. And I judge people on their character, you know, like King said, not by the color of the skin, but just by their character, you know, who you are as a person. You know, come to me, let's have a dialogue. If there's a disagreement or there's something that you see a different way than I do, you know, let's sit down and talk about it, and maybe we can find some common ground, you know, as people. And I hope that people in this book, you know, the autobiography, essays and writings, will understand that. We'll get a better perspective of, you know, who I am as a person.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, I tell you what, man, I really like the fact that you think outside the box, and you seem like the type that really likes to explore, you know what I'm saying, history, and really likes to delve into so many things that we don't have answers for. Like nowadays, you know, cats are using drones and digital mapping, and they're uncovering lost civilizations that we knew nothing about all the time.
Isn't that wild?
You know what I'm
saying? That's wild.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah, that's wild.
Doing documentaries and shows on it all the time, like stuff that vegetation just grew over and hid for 500, 600, 700 years or more.
Yeah.
You know, to have that type of vision, you know, as a filmmaker, you know, what does it take for you to be able to go out there and say, okay, I want this shot to look like this, and I want, you know, you to be over here, you to be over there, like to be able to have a vision. Yeah. How do you do that, and how do you direct people in a way to cater towards your vision?
Great question, because, you know, one of the things I've always done is been a people watcher, you know, studier of human behavior and what motivates people, you know, and studying body language and sort of looking at what's common and what's unique, you know, about us as individuals. And so, and I think also just having an innate curiosity, you know, about the world and about the things around you. And I've been like, you know, my parents would tell me that I was always like that, you know, that, you know, I was never, you know how they say, yeah, but old soul, you never were really a kid. And so I just had this innate curiosity about everything and just a study of human nature and a studier of sort of like what motivates us to do what we do. And out of that, it helps you to sort of relate things to people as a director, and you start to develop a technique of giving, you know, the people you work with, you know, motivation. Because I've directed, you know, also stage plays and in addition to screenplays. And the stage plays are a lot more intimate because when you're on a movie set, you know, you have so much time to get a shot together, and you got to make sure you're prepared. You know, you have your shot list when you come in as a director. You have, you know, maybe you've done some rehearsals, a few, but you don't get a whole lot of time to do that because, again, time is money. And so there's a sort of a different energy, you know, when you're putting that out. But when you're doing, you know, stage plays, you get a little more time to work with the actors and put together sort of like, you know, some choices, you know, help them make, you know, choices for their characters and give them backstory and give them, you know, motivations and whatnot. And so that helps, you know, need to be able to do that. But you were also talking about how do we get shots together and how do we pull them together and decide, you know, what shots you want to make. Every shot, every piece of what you do as a filmmaker, you're telling a story. And I love being a storyteller, and I've always loved telling stories. So taking that sort of idea to another level, you're telling the story visually. And the way you tell the story visually and the shots you put together, people aren't really supposed to be so jarred into noticing, oh, there was an edit right there or there's a cut right there. It's just supposed to flow, you know, and sort of like, you know, when you hear somebody playing, you know, an instrument or playing a violin, it's supposed to flow from one note to the next without it being noticed, but you're supposed to feel something. So the way that I choose my shots and the way that I choose sort of my angles and sort of what pieces to, you know, sort of shoot and have close-ups on and all that, it's all about, okay, does this advance the story? Does this tell the story? Does this help this scene and the actors, you know, and paint this whole picture, you know, of whatever the message is that we're trying to convey? And that's sort of like the way that I, you know, that I approach it and how I make my decisions about that.
Yeah. Definitely, man. Well, you know, it takes a lot of leadership skills. You got to be able to do your thing, man. This Einstein project, I know you've been working on it for a minute. When is it dropping?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked that question. I don't have an actual date, but I can say they told me it was okay for me to say this part. It is in the queue over at the board of directors. There's a special company. What they do is, they have a way of sort of putting all the majors together, Paramount and the MGMs and you know, the Universals and those guys. And they select projects that they specifically think are relevant and important to, you know, the world. And Einstein is that project that is in that queue right now. And they're deciding which studio wants to actually, you know, take it and do the thing with it, you know. And I known about this entity that they have, but to be a part of it now and to be to be one of the premier movie projects that are involved with them, it'll probably be, I can't really say which one, but I do know that the Paramount lot is very, you know, very on it. So once they, you know, put it in the queue and they get it going, then it'll be something that probably will probably shoot it, probably take about, you know, anywhere between 9 to 12 months to actually film it, because it's a major piece. You know, it's one of those pyramid pieces, you know, with costuming and, you know, sets and the whole deal. So it's, you know, it's not a low budget movie. It's one of those, you know, high budget, big budget movies, and it'll be done by a major studio. So as soon as they get all of that together, then I'll have, you know, a bigger announcement. But I can say that it's already in their wheelhouse. You know, it's already something that, you know, they want to do. I think the last time I couldn't even give you that information, but at least I can say that much now. That
it'll definitely be.
And it takes time. You know, the average movie, man, sometimes, you know, 5 years, you know, from its inception till, you know, it actually gets out there. But because this is such a major project, and it's something that will be done as a biopic, and it's something that, you know, for an iconic person, then there are a lot of, you know, entities involved. I can't even say, you know, if I'll be the director or not. You know, I would like to, would love to, but again, you know, I can't even say that at this point. So I'm really just pleased and happy to even be a part of it and have those, you know, major studios to be even, you know, considering even doing it. So I'm pleased about that.
Man, you are a renaissance man because you got so much stuff on the table, ready to blow. You know, we're talking about books, film, you know, all this stuff, you know what I'm saying, advocate, speaking to the youth. Where do you find time for all this? And second part of that question is, man, what do you got coming up as far as music is concerned?
So, yeah, my mother asked me that same question. She said, son, how do you even find the time to do all of this? You know, I just do. You know, I try to be as organized as possible. You know, I'm OCD to the fullest. And when I'm in, you know, in beast mode, you know, if I get 4 hours of sleep, you know, at night, I'm lucky. But it's about getting the job done. You know, somebody once told me, man, you want something done and done right, ask a busy person. So I just, you know, hunker down. And I hopefully, man, I just try to lead by example, you know, and I hope to, you know, be an example and not always try to toot my own horn, but, you know, do something that shows people, you know, that they can do it too. And that's really what it's all about for me. So I just, you know, go for it, man. If there's a project or something I have to get done, you know, I'm there to do it. You know, if there's something I need, you know, to make happen, you know, then, you know, let's make it happen. So, you know, like I said, I'm looking forward to working with Movie Labs on the, you know, on the Einstein Project, and just looking forward to making some things happen, you know, that way as well. And so that my projects that I'm working on now, I'm mainly focused obviously on, you know, the book and doing the, you know, the book signings and the book tour and, you know, the interviews, and really, like I said, just making sure that that story is out there. But we also have the movie projects that we're working on as well. With, you know, of course, Blaze and Amused, the Einstein Project. There's a few more that we have in the queue, but we want to make sure that we get, you know, get them done, get them started, get them done. And then if we move, you know, forward from there, man, and, you know, sky's the limit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Man, well, you got so much on the plate, and I look forward to seeing it all, you know what I'm saying, come to light, man. Starting off with this book today, you know what I'm saying, everybody, you got to go out and support this, you know what I'm saying, clientele, you've been a huge supporter of our show over the years, you know what I'm saying, so we want to make sure our audience goes out and supports you. Now,
man,
it's available right
it's
now
UGS
on the website,
for life.
Right? Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so they can go to CLI-N-TEL.com. They can get it there, or it's available on Amazon today as well. So they can go to Amazon and look up, you know, DJ Clientele, the autobiography, essays and writings of a Renaissance man, modern day Renaissance man. So they can get it there as well. So either way, I know some people prefer to do it on Amazon because it's a lot easier for them to get it that way. You know, or they can, like I said, they can just go to my website and boom, you know, order directly from there. And, then I'll, you know, and hopefully, maybe even at a book signing, you know, near you. So we're working right now, with, some of the folks in the colleges and the universities right now to set up, a book tour and, do it that way as well. So who knows? Might see me in your town.
That would be dope right there, you know. It's all a huge blessing because, like I said, you've been putting in work for years, and you made it possible for other cats to do what they do. So, man, my hat's always off to you, clientele.
Before we get out of here, though, man, please give everybody, you know, all your info in case they want to bring you to their town, man, for a book signing or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, if you want to holler at me, you know, directly, you can DM me, you know, at my Instagram, DJ, DJ underscore CLI underscore N, as in Nancy, underscore TEL, or Twitter, at Mark Hawkins, MARQHAWKINS. You can also just reach me at my, you know, Gmail, which is dj.cli.n.tel@gmail.com. Yeah, and, you know, like I said, any requests for speaking engagements or book signings, you know, we can do that. We can set all of that up and get you there. You know, it's a lot of little tidbits in the book, man, about, like I said, the origin stories of, you know, Dre and, you know, Cube and those cats. But it's also just, you know, about how I grew up and what my musical influences were and just, you know, some good anecdotal stories too as well. So I think it's something that, you know, people will enjoy, and it also fills in a lot of the gaps, man, on West Coast hip-hop history, and it'll be a good addition, I think, to that that whole story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. And also thanks for the love. You know, I saw in the back of the book you mentioned the UGS for Life, Fuck the Lamestream Project.
Sure.
You know, I really
yeah.
appreciate that, man. You know, it's a huge honor. Huge honor.
No, and thank you, man. You know, and I'm humbled and honored as well to, you know, to be working with you guys, because I know how y'all put it down and, you know, how hardcore you are about, you know, making sure this culture survives, and I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you, man. Huge, huge honor. And speaking of this culture, we're going to leave out of here, man, with the title track to 16 Bars for Hip Hop. That's still available, is it not?
Yeah, it is. Actually, it is. They can get that off of the Universal Hip Hop Museum website. It's UHHM.org. Again, it's UHHM.org. But that's dope, man. Yeah, 16 Bars for Hip Hop.
Hell yeah. As always, clientele, thank you, my brother, and we look forward to the next time. And we're going to get out of here. And everybody, please, you know, it's available right now. You need to get the book. You know what I'm saying? You know, like clientele said, it's, you know, you can get it at his website or you can get it on Amazon. You know what I'm saying? Support him. You know, this is one of the good guys, you know what I'm saying, that's trying to keep this culture alive. That's DJ Clientele, the autobiography and writings of a modern-day Renaissance man. Get that right now, and we're going to get out of here, man. Here we go. 16 Bars of Hip-Hop. Clientele.
Jump in the 225 and cruise on down the block. I'd like to invite you to take this ride with me. Maybe hit a couple switches, hit a couple corners, you know how we do. Y'all ready? Let's go.
I got 16 bars to do this, so I don't want to waste one syllable. DJ, put it in your mix. Time to freestyle subliminals. Damn, 4 bars going already, but I'll make up for that. Style reminiscing like diamonds in the back of the Cadillac. A connoisseur cooking up the lyrical, coming with pure fire. Got more flows and doughs than been a China, remind ya. Now I ain't trying to rob nobody of their future, but I'm quicker than a tiger in a car dash, I'll boot ya. From the planet, if you thinking you do damage on this mic, for real, tell me how you really feel. He grazing in the grassy, smelling assy. More sensitive and soft than a box of baby pampies. They wet wipes and tender swipes. To the left, little boy that thought you with the rock, plenty mics. Let's go.
That's what I wrote ya, cause this is my culture. Watch out for the vultures.
16
balls. That's what I wrote ya, cause this is my culture. Watch out for the vultures.
16 balls.
That's what I wrote ya, cause this is my culture. Watch out for the vultures.
16 balls.
That's what I wrote ya, cause this is my culture. Watch out for the vultures.
Uplift the plan, yeah, you the man, how you do? Haters hate when you keep it true. And yes, I'll be the sway. Crab rappers chance to fade. My mom says, son, don't get paid. These dolls can miss me with the bull instead. You wonder why they still rocking that blue or red? At an early age, learn how to get ahead. The happiness we defend is still hanging by a thread. I bring the black rain, king, chocolate thunder. You see me a musical legend, Stevie Wonder. Now I come in peace, but the streets still ain't peaceful. So I pass by the block with my peace, yo. Cause you off that Thunderbird, strip more liquor.
bruise off the boozy liquor. My eyes will never flicker. You're the doozy kicker, that's why the third eye slicker. If you snooze, that's how you lose. My mind is still quicker.
Affiliated, lyrical journey while you stop the humiliation.